First World War, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And after that, they disappeared. There were no more.
No more. Mm-hmm. Oh yes, they were scared. They were such a scared kid too. Mm-hmm. All that, I know. I don't know much about here. They said there were quite a few of them around here too. But I know up the river when I was in school that they used to go around at night time, you know. Dry fish or fish, anything like that. Yeah. And sometimes I heard one time they grabbed a little kit and taken up on the bush, but the people got them in time. And they start chasing them and they let this kit go. Well, down here, the people are saying the same thing. And they had to watch the kit. And even lots of times they had to watch the woman. So.
Why did they want to do it?
Well, I don't know. I just wonder. You take them, I guess that's about all. But
nowadays, is there any belief in these?
Oh, no. No, right. Nobody believes that. No. Never heard of. Not since quite a while now. Not since I left school, anyway. Yeah. After I came back here in 1921, there was no such thing as that. Yeah. No. Nothing at all.
Did your mother or your father tell you that it was bad to whistle in the dark at night?
It used to be, yeah. That's when they believed that because there used to be these bushmen. They stayed up close from town all the time. And at night, so they'd go around and try and get, swipe something, anything at all, they can get hold of it. And therefore, they, sometimes maybe a person would go in a bush and make a hunt like that, and that's the only way that they make themselves known that they're near is whistle.
The bushman.
Yeah,
whistles.
He whistles.
He would be afraid.
Oh yeah, I'd be afraid. But sometimes the hunter, he don't care, you know, as long as he got the gun, well. If they attack him, well, he knows what to do. But the kids, they teach them about this. I mean, they tell them that if somebody whistles like that, there's somebody close by. Don't run away. Don't go away from the camp.
And they also tell the kids not to whistle.
Yeah, they always tell them not to say that.
Did they whistle at daytime?
Oh, yes, around the camp. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But not if they're going to someplace in the bush like a, and they're never, they always tell them to watch for that. I don't know why then these bush people, they whistle like that. Maybe they're trying to scare a person or something like that, you know. That
I heard about these bush people at Fort Mills.
Oh yeah, they were all over Canada. I mean, all over, even around Dawson and all that. Lots of them, they came. But they came, this was mostly white people.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You never heard they might be Creek Indians?
Well, it could be, too.
You never heard that?
Never heard.
Fort Nelson, they thought that in the old days, when the Creek Indians were coming in westward, that the Creek Indians were hiding in the bush,
mm-hmm.
waiting to steal.
Yeah, well, it could be them, too, you know. But
it's a little different every
settlement.
Well, one more question, and I'll end. I'll ask you more like about these next week. Are people able to control what they do? Do you understand what I mean? I'll explain if you don't.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Can they, like somebody steals, he always wants to steal.
Mm-hmm.
Can he control himself? Can he say, I mustn't steal, therefore I won't steal? Or is there something that drives him to do bad things?
Well, so that's what they claim. Somebody is driving them to do it. Before religion came down here, these people up here, they were way different again in that respect, because they always talked to people, talk to the boys, and not to do it, and not to take other people's stuff unless they ask for it. And if they don't, if the person says no, well, you can't get it. But I know the Eskimos were bad for that one time when they were not educated. They go up to my person, you know, and gather up with the people. And they used to sweat the odd things like that, you know. But they watched them pretty close. But as far as the people up here, I think they were, well, they were pretty good on that, because they're most of these people down here, like my person band, most times they travel in band. And if somebody do that quite often, they always tell the chief about it. And the chief would go and have a talk with him. And if he don't listen, well then, he tells them that you'll have to get punished for it. If you don't listen to what I say, well, it'll be too bad for you. Yeah. Well, that's in the old, even in the olden days. And if a person does something like that quite often, or even say going after another people's wives, they got, and they talk to him and he won't listen, well, they'll get rid of him. That's the only way they punish him, is get rid of him.
Mm-hmm. So you believe that people could listen and stop themselves?
Oh, yes,
if they were
behaving
the wrong way.
That's right, if somebody else tells them. See, they got to be told them.
Now, I mean, that's a different kind of thing. Today, some people drink a great deal. I don't mean just in Inuvik, but other places too. They drink a great deal, and they can't seem to stop.
Yeah.
They go to the Pentecostal church and they can't stop. Alcoholics Anonymous, and they can't stop. Do you think that they can stop themselves if they really want to?
Well, I figure, John, as long as they're in town, I think it's pretty hard for them, even if they tried. I mean, even if they try their best. Yet, as I told you before, these people are mixed up, and they're good friends to each other. And if a person say, well, I don't want it. I want to try and quit it. And yet this friend of him, or maybe a good friend of him, say, well, at least you can take one or two anyway. And then you convince him to take that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know lots of boys was here, and they said, oh, I wish I could quit drinking. But he says, friends bother me too much, and he said, I just can't quit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I told him, well, the only way you can quit is get out of this town. Keep away from, go some other place. Go to McPherson or Plavik, or stay out in the bush someplace. I said, if you don't see it for a month or two, well, I said, you wouldn't go so strong for it. Well, he says, I guess that's the only way. But he says, as long as in town, he says, I haven't got the willpower to do it. He says, I'd like to do it. And he says, I can't do it. So I guess that's the only way there.
So this kind of thing is very, very hard to control.
That's right.
Maybe impossible to control.
Yeah.
In some people.
No, with some people, it's very hard for them. And yet, if they go some other place, say go whaling or go some other place with an oil company like that, it don't bother them at all. But once they get back here, well then, they start all over again.
You mean the young man going to the oil company for 2 to 3 months?
Yeah.
That's a good way to...
That's a good way. Uh-huh. But then if they come back, well, they just can't quit it. I mean, they start all over again. But there's very, very few people that's got there. Willpower saying that, well, I'm going to finish and that's it. That's very few.
Well,
what they, I know them because I mean I've been with the people a long time now, and the only people, and very few natives have that, but I know the white people, they got a lot of willpower.
Well, there are some white people who can't control it.
Well, sometimes, yes, lots of times too, but I mean, I know quite a few that I mean, they still have the odd drink like that, but I mean, they don't crave for it. It's just maybe once in a while they have a drink and that's it. But when they were single, after they got single, oh boy, you think they've never quit. But once they get married, well, they settle down.
So
that marriage helps them. Well, providing what kind of woman they marry. Oh, well, most of them are drinking now. Even girls are drinking. And if they, I know a lot of couples that get married, and the first thing they do is they hit for the bar. Get a case of beer, and the woman, and then the girl and the boy drinking. Well, they're just newly married, and then maybe next night they do the same thing. Well, they keep up, and after a while they just can't keep up. They'll never quit. Nothing to do with it, yes. That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then he gets a good woman and sure that he to his wife, if he loves his wife, well I think he can quit it if you try anyway. But very, very few of us quit it around here.
Well, now, if a man or a woman wants the kids to be dressed nicely and wants his own house, wants to build a house, you know, a good house, not just a 512 or something like that, then he's got to stop.
Yeah, he's got to.
Marriage might be a help there, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But most of these boys, I mean, some of them are pretty, exactly all of them. Very few that I know that don't. I know some of them was in this Pentecostal church for a number of years, never touched. And I see quite a few of them to start all over again. Yeah. I know especially one boy here, oh, he's a nice boy. When he was married, boy, he'd never even think of it. He comes here, he works at a radio station. And last year his wife died and he just took for the liquor part. Now, and he used to be one of the real Christians, so they call themselves down there. Well, he used to be one of them and never bothered with it. Now, boy, he's right into it right now.
Do you think that when something like that happens, wife dies or a child dies, that makes a man worse for drinking?
No, I think the only thing they take it for to keep them off their mind. And that's the only thing that I figure they do that for. Because I know this boy, I mean, he's a real good friend of mine. He's an Eskimo. Mm. But when his wife was living, they always come and visit us, you know, and sit around. We have tea together. And then they go out happy. And whenever they come to town, they always come and visit us.
Mm-hmm.
And after he lost his wife, he come over himself and he felt really bad. You know, he said, it's too bad. And my friend is there. And I used to come to town. This is my wife and me. We always visit you. But now he says, I come alone, he says, I really feel bad. Well, I told him, just try and forget about it and go around and just see the people. Look at the sight or something like that, try and forget about it. Maybe you could go for a ride or something like that. And I said, try not to think about it. That's the only way you can get over it. Maybe I say you're still young. Someday I says maybe if you want here, I see him, and really drinking. And he, my pleasure, say the other day, he just met me, and he was feeling pretty good. And he says, "My friends, I'm sorry to do this, but," he says, "I still can't forget my wife." And he says, "The only way sometimes I do is then I forget and I feel happy with it, with everybody. That's the only way, that's the only thing I do this for." Well, I told him, "Well, that's your business, but that's just take care of yourself, anyway." But he's a nice guy, he's a nice boy you can meet, you know. But he says that's the only way you can forget about it sometimes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And,
and he says that lots of times he says, I go to bed, but he says, "I can't sleep." You know, he says, "Tired. I want to sleep, but he says, I can't do it. I think too much." So that's why I think now. What was my last?
The last time you were portaging from the Rat River across from Single Rock to
my person. That's right.
And you said that with you, you began to live in Iqaluit.
That's right. Uh-huh. Well, we came back over to my person after we left the lady. And we stayed there a few days, about 2 days, and then we boarded the canoe and we had to paddle back to Iqaluit.
You and Sidney?
Yes. Lazarus to the ship. Mm-hmm. And we got back to Iqaluit. And then one morning I was staying with this, my brother-in-law. Another one, Joe Vena. I always stay with him when I go to the Iqaluit, you see. Mm-hmm. He's married to a cousin of mine, but he just called me brother-in-law all the time. So I stay with him, and he told me it's going to be lots of work after a while, he says, but right now, so I haven't got much, but he says, as soon as the boat comes in, so it's going to start working. So I seen Mr. Parsons, that's the manager there. I told him I just came back from this trip and so I got nothing to do, I got a new job. And yes, he said, "Then it's going to be lots of work," but he said, "We have to wait until the next boat come in."
Mm-hmm.
So I told him, okay. So I camped that next night. I was sleeping, and early in the morning, his Joe Green come in. He says, and I was still sleeping, "This must be about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was still sleeping. Nothing to do, so I slept in." He woke me up and he says, "Come on, get up." He said, "The police is looking for you." Well, them days when you call the police, you know, everybody gets scared, you know. So I woke up right away and I thought, "What have I done the police are looking for me for?" And I figured I didn't do anything wrong. So I told him, "Okay, I'll go down and see them after." "No, no, no, no." He said, "You've got to come with me." He said, "The police is looking for you right now." He said, "Go ahead and get washed." And he says, in the meantime, the corporal had come in with him, but he didn't tell me that, you see. So it was, I was sleeping upstairs. And they had another little wash down there with water and basin there. So he kept getting after me, telling me, "Hurry up, because," he said, "the police are really looking for you." So I got washed and got dressed. I come downstairs, "By golly, here's the police." The corporal got that too. So the corporal says to me, "Jim, so you drank last night?" I said, "No, corporal, I didn't drink last night." So I just came back from my person. I says, I went right to bed. I walked around town for a while. Then I came home and I went to bed and never drank. He said, "I'm sure I heard you was drinking." "No." So I said, "No, I never drink." And he started to laugh. come on, Jimmy, said, I'm just only teasing you. He said, I knew you were scared. And he said, come here, inspector is down here now. And he says, we had to let our interpreter go. So he said, we want the interpreter. And I heard that he was a good worker. He said, I seen Mr. Parsons. And he says, yeah, Mr. Parsons said that he worked around here quite a while now. And he said, we want you to work for us. So he says, you would take the job. He says, I want you to come down and meet the inspector with me now. So I told him, well, I says, Corporal, I'll try anyway. So I'm still young. So I haven't traveled too much in the Delta before, and I've never traveled on the coast. I says, I can understand my language, but I can't understand the Eskimo language. But I says, if you can get somebody someday to help you out in Eskimo language, well, I said, I'll take the job. So he says, well, thanks very much. And he says, come on down with me right now. He says, well, go to the office. So he got in the office, and the inspector was there. And they gave me the job. So the inspector told me, well, Mr. Cooley, he says, you're a young man. He says, you're going to work with the police here. He said, you're not married, so he says, you're not going to have no place of your own. He said, you're going to stay right with the police in the barracks. He said, that's where your home is going to be, as long as you work. So he says, I am stationed at Herschel Island. He said, you'll be making patrols with the police down there twice a year, maybe some possible three times a year. And you'll be patrolling all over this delta here with the police. And in the meantime, so you'll be working at the detachment here. So I do hope that you have good luck and stay with us. He said, how much he's going to pay me a month? He said, we give you $75 a month. But you eat with the police, and you'll have a home there. So I told him, fine, I'll take the job. So I stayed with him that winter. And the spring, we had to, well, even that winter, we had to patrol all over the delta here, Arctic Ranger and McPherson. We had to cut our own wood. Mm-hmm. Them days, it's no oil, you know. Yeah. Everybody's burned wood. We had to go in the bush and cut cordwood for the next winter light. And then we made about two trips that year to Herschel Island, one in the fall and one in the spring. And that's when the inspector comes up with us to a Klavik. And he stays in the Klavik until the first boat comes in. And then he goes back after that. After the boat leaves, then he goes back. So I stayed with him that winter, that summer, and the next winter, and in the spring, I quit.
Any reason?
Yeah, because I figured $75 a month wasn't very much, and the rats went up to $1.50 a piece.
Uh-huh.
Now, them days, they don't grade rats. You just shoot or trap the rats. And if you kill any amount of rats, well, they pay you $1.50 right through. And that's good money and lots of rats.
Yes. Before you go on, did you have to travel, like in this country, down here, where the water is all, you know, where it's all crisscrossed with water? Did you know your way?
Oh, yes.
Did you know your way?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. That was a new
country for you. Oh, yeah. But you see, this, you can tell where is trap lines, and you can tell where is the main road. And therefore, unless the snow is covered the trail real deep, well, then you can't tell the difference. But still, if you don't lose that trail, you always get to a camp anyway.
And what would you make these patrols for? Why did they patrol in the delta?
Well, just to see that everything goes well, you know. Nothing goes, maybe somebody gets sick or somebody don't happen to see them a long time. And they just go around and see that everything is good amongst
they
the people.
Visit the camps?
Yeah, visit the camps.
Mm-hmm. Sleep overnight
in camps? Oh, yes, sure.
In their own tent or do they put up all the big...
No, more them days, you see, most of the people, they have cabins in the bush. They make their cabins.
So you would stay with the Eskimo people?
As well as the Indian people.
Well, the Indian people
uh-huh.
In the bush.
That's right. Oh, yes, we camp right with them.
Right, that's a lot of people.
Oh, lots of them. And then we pack lots of grub, too. And lots of dog feed. All of that.
And you're a squad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We always have two teams, like, you know.
Two teams?
Two team of dogs.
He would drive one.
Oh, yes, he'd drive his own, and I'd drive my own. And in that way, there was lots of people in the Delta them days. And actually, we never packed tent and stove. Because, say, about every 25 miles, there's a camp anyway. Mm-hmm. So
and you would visit all of them, or just
wherever. Not trouble, just go around and see the people. See how they're doing, you know. And some maybe somebody get short of grub, or somebody get real sick, or something like that. Well, and the people maybe don't know about it. Well, they happen to see this, you see. Well, then they give the people a handout like that.
You mean give relief?
Oh, yes. Yes, a little bit. If they need it, they give it them. Mm-hmm. Sure.
And how are the police to travel with?
They're very good. Never bother nothing. Never bother the interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the guy takes them there, well, that's all they worry about. Sometimes you have hard trail, and you have to wear snowshoes like that. Mm-hmm. Well, the interpreter would walk ahead of the dogs, and he'd take care of the slaves like that. But they're very nice people to travel along with.
Did you have any adventures? Anything special happen?
No, not when I was with them. Just one time they had we heard a report that some white guys were trapping out to see them, trapping early in the fall. So we had to go up there and look around. Because that time we had two police with us, with me, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we got up to their camp, and they asked them about it, and they traveled all over their trap lines and everything, but they didn't find any fur, so there was no proof that they were trapping out the season. That's the only thing that I got into mix up with a little trouble like that.
Are those white men still in this
country? Oh, no, they left long ago. I guess they're all gone now. It's a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, some people are staying too.
Yeah. But I wish I was had a little more brains that time, like I said before, that. That's the Indian world. If they knew that there was a good future ahead of them, and they annoyed that, they always say, "I wish I had the brains that I used to have, like I have now."
Why do you say that?
Well,
sorry you left.
I'm sorry I left because if I'd have stuck with the police, I'd have been in pension long, long time ago.
Did they give a pension?
Oh yes.
After 20 years.
Yeah, after 20 years. Oh, yeah. I don't know, the pension plan, of course, now I think it's maybe went a little higher. Of course, the boys down there told me that I had to be in 25 years now. But the old pension system was 20 years. Because the corporal that I worked under, He was just a young boy, young man. I was young, but I think he was still younger than me. And he was a corporal. And he always tell me about this pension business, you know. But then I thought, well, I don't like to stick with the job that long. I'd rather go traveling. And then after he left, well, then I didn't want to stay longer, so I quit.
I see. Mm-hmm. You enjoyed the 2 years that he was
working with you, that's right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Then after he quit, you know, I thought, well, maybe I wouldn't get along with the next guy or something like that, so I thought, well, if he's gone, I might as well quit too. Mm-hmm.
Was it in the spring that you quit?
No, in the fall.
Because
mm-hmm. he left on the last boat, like that would be, yeah. And I stayed until it froze over, and then I quit. And that's the time the Northern Trading Company was in Atlantic. And this guy was a single man. So I thought I either go trapping or work for this, ask a job off this guy here.
He offered you a job?
No. I thought I was going to ask him. So I went over to him and I told him that I wanted to quit the police, but I still want to work until springtime. I got a job here. Well, he says, actually, it's not very much doing around here, Jim, but he says, at times it gets a little too much for me for one guy here. He says, sure, you can work for me. He says, I'm here all alone. He says, you might as well come right in and stay with me right in the house. So, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
So he looks after the books, and he told me, how about you look after the store. And he says, in the meantime, he says, when there's not many people around, so you can work outside, maybe cut wood or bring in ice for the water,
mm-hmm.
and bring in wood in the evenings. And he says, that way, you can help me that way. And I said, well, that'll be fine. So I stayed right with him, and afterwards, he says, make sure, he says, in the store that this is the way you give out the stuff. But any fur that comes in, he says, it's me to buy it. He says, don't buy any fur. So he just, and then when he says, when they got credit coming, he says, I'll give you a note. And he says, they take that credit out, and that's it. You know. But if they want some credit, he says, you tell them to ask me and I give you paper. And if I say yes, well, you give them that amount. So then I look after the store for him all winter.
Mm-hmm.
So in the spring, the word came in. By that time, the wireless was in the clinic, you see. The army signal came in, and they put up a station in McClavick. So he got a wire and saying that they were going to build a new store in Fort McPherson. And they wanted a guy to be up there that can understand as an interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
So one morning we got up, and he says, Jim, he says, the first boat, he said, I guess you'll have to go to McPherson. He said, our company is going to build a new store. And they asked me to pick out a man. He says, how about you go up there? So I told him, yeah, sure, that'll be fine. And then in the meantime, well, I was young then, ready to get married anytime.
Mm-hmm.
Old woman came to me. And he says, my grandson, he says, I want you to meet, to marry my daughter. Sometimes they do that in the olden days. If they want to see a person, a boy, or even a mother, that knows that they're trying and they behave themselves, well, the mother would go and says, hey, could you marry my daughter? Or could you, that's how they generally do in the olden days. So this old woman came to me and he says, my daughter, you know, he says, you know her. She says, she's been in school for a long time now. And she's coming back. And he says, I'm poor. And he says, I can't look after my daughter like that she's looked after in school. He says, maybe my daughter wouldn't like that. He says, would you, if you don't mind, if you could marry my daughter. Well, a pretty old woman. Well, I says, I don't intend to get married yet, but I says, I'll have to think it over for a few days, and then I says, I'll let you know. So I thought it over, and I thought, well, I might as well settle down this, in life. And so there's no use staying single all this time. By that time, I was getting on to 25 years old.
Yeah.
So I told my dad about this old woman. And my dad says, well, he says, I won't tell you what to do, but he says, you know that old woman is poor, and he says, maybe she wants to try to get a home for her daughter. So I'd leave it up to you. So I told her, well, I guess I'll get married. So, but she was supposed to come back on the boat, like.
The girl.
The girl, yes. But we had to go to McPherson before the boat came in. So I told the manager, I says, Pat, I got no boat here. I said, I got a lot of stuff. I said, how are you going to get me up there? Well, he said, we'll hire a boat to him. I said, don't worry about that. I said, who can you get? So I told him, well, I know a boy that's got a whaleboat here. Got a little engine, but I said, all you need is to give him gas, and we'll pay him so much a day. I told him, say, $10 a day or something like that. Well, he said, that's okay, fine. So I loaded up that whaleboat, and we went to McPherson 2 days before the boat came in. So I got up there, and I had my own tent and stove. I knew he told me exactly where they're going to put up the building. It was in the old police property. That's way at the end of town, like. So when I landed there, I told this boy, help me put up my tent. And I said, we have to unload all that stuff. Oh, I had a lot of stuff.
Your own stuff?
My own stuff.
Did you have your boy?
No. It's my own, one of my own cousins again. Mm-hmm. So we unloaded the stuff, and I stayed right on the beach there. There's a big mud bar right in front of my person, but it's all full of willows, though. Oh, the willows are thick there. So I told him I'd rather not move up there until the boat comes here. Because I said, the boss is coming in, and after he comes in, well, then I'll move up there. So he said, that'll be fine. So he put up the tent with me, and then I told him, well, you're not going right back. I said, you might as well have a camp with me and then go back tomorrow. I said, I'll have to give you a note to the manager down there so he can pay you anyway. So he camped with me. So the next day the boat come in. And sure enough, the outfit come in, lumber and everything. So I met this manager, and I told him that I was sent up here from Clavick to work for you up here to help you put up this building. So I just came in yesterday. Oh, that's fine, Jim. It's very good. I'm glad you're here. So we'll put up the camp right away. In the meantime, my wife come in too, on that same boat. And I knew she was coming, you see, so. Oh, I didn't want to go down and meet her. I was kind of a little bashful, you know, because I'd never seen her since she was about that big. So I told George, and I told him, well, his name is George Douglas. This guy, this manager. So I told Mr. Douglas, I'm supposed to be getting married too here. I says, my wife is on the same boat as you. And I say, I haven't got even a place to stay. Well, he says, Jim, I can't help you out for a place to stay. He says, you know, we're just going to start now. And I said, we'll be staying in that tent too. And he says, there's no house available. You can't get housing. He says, we just got two housing, and that's for the outfit, you see. So he said, how about putting up a big tent and fix that up until we get a house built. And then he said, we can try and settle in before the winter. So I found we were fine. So they put up a big tent for me up there, fixed up everything for the night, and asked me what time I was going to get married, and all that, probably maybe tomorrow, maybe next day. So that's okay, fine. But in the meantime, we were putting up this tent and trying to unload the boat at the same time. You know. And we were working, we hired about 20 guys to get up and straighten up as fast as we can. Get all the stuff up and like this. And by that time, it's getting on to the 9th of August. So, August 9th, August the 10th, 1909, I get married. And since that time, we've been. I worked for them there for a couple of years. And I didn't like to work there. It was kind of hard. No, that the first winter, we got a house. They didn't build me a house. There was a house there, which we fixed up.
Log cabin.
Log cabin, yeah. Just enough for a couple, size, a little bigger than a tent anyway. So we stayed there. Then the following year, they built me a house. And I stayed there, but the McPherson them days was a very hard place to make a living like, you know. It's no caribou within miles, and hard to get fish. And then we had to haul our own wood with dogs, no cat. And I had to haul wood for three houses, like their store, the manager house, and myself. Now I keep the dog team and man busy to keep them fires going alone. So, well, they don't pay me very much. I think they paid me about altogether $150 a month.
With rations?
With rations. That's including rations, about $150. But still it's not enough, you know, for them days. So I got stayed with them 2 years and then I quit. And then I went traveling.
Well, we'll fix that up the next time.
Yeah.
Any special adventures while you were working for them in that prison?
Well, one thing about it, John, is one thing, it's nothing much, but I think that's one of the first lumber building come up in the first.
That store was one of the first.
And I think that's about one of the first lumber builder.
Did you help build it?
Oh, yes. The carpenter was there.
Carpenter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes.
And
yeah.
You worked with him?
Yeah, I worked with him. All summer.
And?
It was about. See, they were really in a hurry, and they hired about 10, 15 boys for the summer to put up the store quick, and the house too for the manager. So I think that's one of the first, probably one of the first lumber buildings that was Dustin McPherson there.
Well, we can pick up the story there the next time.
Yeah.
That was Jim Coey, recorded on July 3rd, and after a number of interruptions in which I didn't tape his interviews, this will be tape number 7, I believe, and that's the end of recording on this side.